This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. 4 weeks. That's how long it's been since the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, and emotions continue to run high.
We're not just going to stand by while an extremist minority tries to undo decades of progress and take away the rights of millions of Americans.
In Washington, they spilled out onto the streets.
This just then, Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley and Catherine Clark were arrested outside the Supreme Court earlier this afternoon. Both were taking part in a protest in support of abortion rights.
Locally, the debate centers on one word.
The sticking point is over abortions after 24 weeks and the word severe.
And how to help now.
I have a lot of guilt for my daughters that I gave them a world that is worse than what I had.
Congresswoman Lori Trahan on our air this week, NBC 10 on the SCOTUS rally, WBUR Steve Brown, and Diane Rhee, a Massachusetts resident, on her decision to help people travel to the state to get abortion. So lots to dive into. Joining us, Renee Landers, professor of law at Suffolk University, and Michael Curry, CEO of the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers and a member of the NAACP's board of directors. Renee and Michael, welcome back to both of you.
Glad to be
Thanks
back.
Very much.
So, Renee, you were with us 4 weeks ago today when we did special coverage at 3 p.m. when Roe v. Wade came down. Michael, this is our first time talking to you since then. Where were you that day when you got the news, and what happened in your mind?
Yeah, for me, we were expecting it, right, because of the leaked memo. And then two, you know, we in the civil rights community have been huddling for days, if not weeks, actually, trying to think about how we would respond to it, what we needed to do, particularly from a standpoint of the disparate impact this will have on Black and brown women and their reproductive health and around this issue of reproductive justice. I was at the Mass League at the time and getting calls from so many folks asking me, okay, what do we do and what do you need me to do around this? So we're still here.
So, Renee, that day you provided us a lot of legal analysis of the case itself, et cetera. Over these last 4 weeks, has anything legal new emerged for you? Is there anything new you're watching?
I would say that the most significant thing is that some of the worst concerns about the Dobbs decision overturning Roe v. Wade have started to materialize. States have enacted laws banning abortion with no exceptions for rape or incest. Some of the exceptions for the health of the pregnant person, of the woman, are, very narrowly interpreted. And so I think we're seeing states walking into the opening that the Supreme Court has given them to really enact some of the most restrictive abortion laws, obviously, that we have seen in a very long time.
Michael Curry, take us into the minds and the workplaces of medical providers when those regimes are put forth. How does that affect care that isn't even illegal, let alone care that was and now isn't?
Yeah, I think, you know, for the folks that I've talked to out of state, you know, we're fortunate in Massachusetts that we have a government and systems here in the state that will protect that right to that care. But many of the folks I'm talking to across the country, I just got off a plane just hours ago from the National NAACP Convention in Atlantic City, where this was highly talked about. People coming from southern states, many of those states, those 21 or so that are now putting these anti-abortion laws into place. And I think those providers are talking about what the criminality of this is and whether they could be prosecuted for even referring a woman to such services, even if it were out of state. What is the impact on their patients who seek these services out of state and potentially that being criminalized? What is the impact on Black and brown patients, poor immigrant patients, poor people generally, who can't travel to Mexico or who might not be able to travel up to Massachusetts or somewhere where abortion is legal. This creates another two Americas. We've had several versions of America being more than one. But when it comes to women's reproductive health, this is going to create yet another two Americas.
I want to bring us to this week, and here's a little sound for you.
If we don't get it, shut it down!
Please stay
Now, that came from Massachusetts Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley's own Twitter account. Both she and Massachusetts Congresswoman Catherine Clark were among more than a dozen members of Congress arrested on Wednesday at an abortion rights rally outside of the Supreme Court. The reason cited by the arresting police is because they were blocking traffic. So, Renee, anything, I don't want to create conspiracy where there isn't. I am not a lawyer. It was striking to hear about members of Congress being arrested for what appeared to be peaceful protests. So break that down for us a little bit.
Yeah, I would say that, you know, the First Amendment does have very broad protections for peaceful protest. Municipalities, governments can impose what time, place, and manner restrictions. And, you know, disrupting traffic, that sort of thing could be viewed as one of those, lawful regulations of protest. I will say, however, that the immediacy of the response to these peaceful protests is in striking contrast to what we've been hearing in the January 6th hearings in the Congress about the very slow response to what was a violent protest at the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2020, so 2021. And so I think, and also I guess the other thing I would say about all of this is that the Supreme Court, since the Dobbs decision has come down, has shown a very thin skin about accepting the results of the First Amendment law it has made about the right of people to peacefully protest in front of abortion clinics, at funerals of veterans. And now they're experiencing this very open-ended approach to the First Amendment. And I don't think that it's a good look for them to try to exempt themselves from the rules that they've made for everybody else.
Michael, when you saw our congresswomen arrested, was that a moment where you thought, that's appropriate, that's grandstanding, that's important? What was your reaction to it?
Well, you know, Ayanna has been a longtime friend of mine way before she became a congresswoman, and I know her compass, Professor Landers, right? I'm not talking about your gut, right? I'm talking about your compass that comes from reading The Souls of Black Folk or Institute of Medicine's Unequal Treatment or CAST, Isabel Wilkerson's book. That is the person I know, Ayanna Pressley. She's very much ingrained or grounded in the civil rights work. So when I saw that, Tiziana, I actually thought of John Lewis. I thought about John Lewis's Good Trouble. And I said, you know, this is the Ayanna I know getting in good trouble and standing up. And I did, like Professor Landers, thought back to the fact that I've been watching these hearings on January 6th, and those folks got to walk away. They got to walk away after they ransacked and were participated in insurrection against our government. And yet she's standing up for the right of women to choose and was arrested. That contradiction stuck with me.
And did it make you angry?
I've learned to be angry about a lot of things. So I think maybe to some degree I'm weathered to the fact that there's so much to be angry about. In order for me to be an activist, and I am on a daily basis on this stuff, anger is not where I try to go. I try to turn that frustration maybe into some activism. So now we need to turn out for the midterms. Now these state legislatures need to be overrun by Black and brown and women voters who want to take back those legislative seats. Now we need to make sure that we're looking at the construct of the Supreme Court as a possibility. We need to have all the cards on the table at this point.
That voice is Michael Curry, who is the CEO of the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers and a member of the NAACP's Board of Directors. Also with us, Renee Landers, who is a professor of law at Suffolk University. We're diving into one of the big stories of the week, which is national and local movement, let's say, on the abortion ban. So, Renee, I'm going to come back. I'm going to bring us really local, and I'm going to play a bit of an explainer from WBUR's own Steve Brown here.
They really have to get this to the governor's desk ASAP. If they can get it to him before Thursday, they would have just enough time to deal with any potential vetoes. Now, remember, Governor Baker vetoed the part of the Roe Act that allowed for abortions after 24 weeks in the cases of fetal anomalies. So it's a safe bet that he would have concerns about the word severe as well.
So for listeners, At Heart is a debate on a single word between the House and the Senate version of the next round of legislation in Massachusetts to reinforce abortion services in the Commonwealth. The word severe fetal anomaly after 24 weeks would be, it would authorize abortions for any infant with a severe, infant is a loaded word. What I mean is a fetus with a severe fetal anomaly versus fatal, which is the word that's in law today, even though Governor Baker vetoed it on that basis when the Roe Act was originally passed. So all of that for context. How important is a single word, Renee Landers, to legislation?
Well, obviously, it can be very important. And a single word that is undefined and the word itself is not defined in the bill that is that the conference committees are addressing, and so I think that leaves some uncertainty on the part of physicians and on the part of patients who might find themselves in circumstances where a late term abortion after 24 weeks might seem the best decision for the person, the individual, and their family. And so, I do think, however, that what can be lost in sight of in all of this is that there are a lot of other provisions in that legislation that are very important to protect the rights of the LGBTQ community. And, really solidify the right to abortion and reinforce it and to protect providers from legal action in other states that Michael was referring to earlier, for actually assisting an out-of-state person from a state where abortion is banned to come to Massachusetts and having an abortion here. To protect all of those protections, it would be very helpful to have them enshrined in the statute. And I think that it's very important to have some version of this statute enacted this year.
So with that ringing in our ears, Michael Curry, I'll turn to you. We know that the legislature is on a deadline both to get this passed before the end of the legislative session, and if they want to veto-proof it from Governor Baker, it has to be before the end of the legislative session. We talked to Congresswoman Lori Trahan earlier this week about whether she thinks it's going to get done. Here's what she said.
I know that they're working through a few minor differences right now, and I fully expect them to reach an agreement on that legislation, just as they did when they passed the Roe Act, which has been critical already in protecting our reproductive care.
And reminder that the critical Thursday Steve Brown mentioned in his cut here earlier was yesterday. So important clarity in that word severe, lots of other things that the legislature wants to get in place. At what point, Michael, does one let the disagreement go to make sure that it gets done? Or is that the wrong way to think about it?
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, for those of us who track the legislative process, this is how the sausage is made, right? You have to do the debate. You have to reconcile the versions between the House and Senate. And some of that goes into the final hours. And, we wait for them to reconcile. When I think about some phenomenal women leaders, including our Senate President Spilka, and I think about Cindy Friedman, Healthcare Financing Chair, and Representative Marjorie Decker, and so many other people I could name in the Black and Latino Legislative Caucus, I feel confident this will get done as well. These people, like I said earlier, they're driven by a compass. And that compass means that they want to do this and make sure that women are protected here in Massachusetts. And when the women that come to Massachusetts are protected, and I think they'll reach the finish line and they'll get this done.
We're talking with Michael Curry and Renee Landers about developments both in the state and nationally around the end of abortion rights by the Supreme Court and what comes after. And I want to focus now, Renee Landers, a little more on what comes after. One of our colleagues, Gabriella Emanuel, here at WBUR, reported on a story about both tensions and efforts to help women from out of state come to Massachusetts to receive reproductive and abortion care, tension around what's the best way to help. And they use a code word, camping, to disguise coming to the state for that care. Here's a little bit of sound for you.
Generally in the movement, we're all very clear around how to best serve the people that we're trying to help and center their experience, not center ourselves. If I'm offering a guest room, I'm offering that because it makes me feel good.
So part of that was Kate Glynn of the Abortion Rights Fund of Western Massachusetts. Part of that debate is, do you open your homes? Do you just give money? How do you support? This is the next wave, Renee Landers, and it comes among a series of conversations nationally and locally about how pro-life advocates may try to restrict women's right to move from state to state to receive abortion care. How realistic is that possibility of that kind of restriction?
I think it is not crazy to be concerned about that. Justice Kavanaugh, in his concurrence in the Dobbs decision, said, oh, well, you know, the right to travel is very well established under constitutional doctrine. Well, it sits in the same place almost as the right to abortion. It's an unenumerated right. The Constitution says nothing about the right to travel. Perhaps one can make an inference from the existence of the states that, you know, having a united country is, you know, implies the right of people to travel freely among the states. But I think that that's going to be another target of the anti-abortion movement, is to try to restrict the ability of people to travel. And, you know, I think that if you think about countries that have tried to do that, Ireland before the referendum legalized abortion in that country, sought to ban travel, which was struck down by the European Union courts. The communist countries of, you know, the former Soviet Union, Russia, China today, have severe restrictions on travel for people in their countries. I think this is not not something that, you know, the United States should accept willingly. But I do think that that is the only way for these states to, you know, achieve their goal, which is that women not have abortions.
Michael Curry, we have about a minute left, and I'm struck by you talking about coming back from the NAACP conference and the conversations that were happening there. Here in the Commonwealth, we recognize we will be a place that is attractive to people who want to seek abortion care if they're in a state where they can't. Did you hear conversations at the conference, just briefly, about how to support women with interstate travel?
Yeah, I think we're not there yet. We're really trying to get people mobilized around this decision and what it means for their state legislatures and turning back policy in their state as we look at states like Oklahoma and many of these other southern states, South Dakota, Louisiana, Texas, Tennessee. So we're at that point. When we start to think that there's going to be some travel restrictions, we'll have to mature in our advocacy to see how we respond to that. I often lift up a Dr. King quote, "A threat to justice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere." So we can't sit in Massachusetts and think that we're protected here. We need to worry about the folks of the other states, and they're coming for other rights next. Voting rights is still under attack. There are so many other areas that this has implications for, and we need to get ready for that.
All right, that is Michael Curry, who is CEO of the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers and a member of the NAACP's Board of Directors. Also with us, Renee Landers, Professor of Law at Suffolk University. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Isaac Fitzgerald is a New York Times bestselling author and a frequent contributor to The Today Show, and it's hard not to be engaged by his energetic, enthusiastic delivery. Just listen to him speak with Today Show host, co-host Hoda Kotb a couple of months ago.
What is a good beach read? Define it for me.
Oh, for
you
me,
open
it's
it up and
you're
what?
On the beach, you're getting that summer sea breeze, the sand is in your toes, and it's something that just takes you away almost like a second vacation on your vacation.
But behind that bubbly persona, Fitzgerald lived a life that was at times full of abuse, suffering, loneliness, even suicidal thoughts. And in his new book, Dirtbag Massachusetts, A Confessional, he tells his story without any whitewashing. We connected with Isaac when he was in town earlier this week, and he told us more about his childhood.
It starts right here in Boston, and I was very fortunate, and that's the word I want to use. I was very fortunate to be involved with the Catholic Worker. So there used to be a soup kitchen down on Haley House. Eventually, my family and I make our way into the John Larry House, which is basically like a halfway home that the Catholic Worker was running. Those were some of the best years of my life.
But then, at the age of 8, his life changes forever, and not in a good way.
This was a tough neighborhood. 80s, let's be honest. South End was a little bit different than maybe it is now. I think my family, for different reasons, decided that things were getting a little too tough. my mother and I move out to North Central Massachusetts.
So this is at 8 years old where you almost have a reverse Harry Potter moment.
That's an incredible way to put it, yeah.
And so you head out there and then your life is just different.
It's completely different, and that's absolutely right. It was hard in the city, but it was filled with joy and love. The country felt very, very lonely. And it was very, very difficult. And I believe my mother was struggling with lots of different issues, including the fact that, you know, hindsight 2020, I can now see that this was a soft separation for my parents. I didn't know that at the time. But I basically became someone she leaned on at the age of 8 years old. There was really nobody else for her to talk to.
And we're talking probably, whether diagnosed or not, severe depression, suicidal tendencies, thinking about self-harm.
That's completely, completely correct. And actually acting some of this out. But again, when you're a child, you don't really understand that. You don't understand that you're maybe having a unique childhood. You don't understand that maybe not everybody else is going home to this exact same situation. So that's what the rest of the book is about. And it took me years to figure that out. But it was about my childhood. And then it's about how I reacted to that childhood. Most of which, for years and years and years, was denial. Oh, this isn't about that. This is about me finding my own way. And then it wasn't only, you know, I'm about to be 40, approaching, you know, late 30s. I start therapy, and it's about how I start to realize, no, everything I've been doing is in reaction to that. And really, at the core of this, this book is about a family that explodes, and in a very new, very unique, very different, yet still beautiful way, comes back together. Both of my parents had children. So I like to say we're more
before
of a,
you when they were in those other marriages.
Yeah, so I've got a half brother, half sister. I say we're more of a family shrub than a family tree. but my siblings now have children, and our family is coming back together. So that's this book is about that childhood. It's about the ways that I reacted to it, but then it is also about how this family is finding a new way forward.
You talk about this family, the story of how a family explodes.
Yeah.
One of the things that's striking from the book is there's this family explosion, and you realize at some point in your life, you think you were the bomb.
That's right.
And I don't know what it means to carry the idea that your entire existence destroyed things for people you love and the things you loved for those people.
For the longest time, if you had asked me, especially from when I was very young until not that long ago, I would say I was a mistake. That is how I viewed myself, and that is what I carried. And that was the story that I told myself, because that's the other thing this book is about. It's about how we can structure our lives around stories that we either learn or internalize or start to tell ourselves. And sometimes those stories can be really beneficial. They can be dreams that get us out of situations, that actually make us go live a wonderful life. But they can also sometimes be stories that we're telling ourselves that belittle ourselves. And that's what I did for a very, very long time. I truly thought I was a mistake. And so, again, this isn't even in the book, and I obviously don't want to spoil the ending, but it's important to me that this book is not just a perfect present. It's not a perfect bow. It's not all wrapped up.
It's not.
No, it's no, exactly.
It's called Dirtbag Massachusetts.
It's an ongoing conversation. And so to that point, my mom has now read the book. My mother has read the book. And one of the things she said to me that instantaneously changed everything was, I had no idea you were carrying this.
Did she internalize that she in some ways wrote the book?
Yeah. I think she really, the more we talk about it, because we are having some of the best, most in-depth, most connected conversations that we've ever had, you know, maybe since I was far too young to be having some of them. But we're really reconnecting around this book. And I think part of it, what she's realizing, that this isn't my story, this isn't my book, this is our story. And she's very much at the heart of it.
I feel like listeners need to understand, if we're going to talk about this part, mm-hmm. they need to understand that there is a point in the book where you recount, once you've moved to Western Massachusetts, and we're going to come back to mm-hmm. that she says out loud to you, maybe I shouldn't have had you.
Yeah, that's right.
And so that's what we're talking about when we're talking about the journey from them to then to now with your mom.
Yeah.
Had she ever told you the opposite? I'm so glad I had you.
That's what's happening now. When she said, I had no idea you were carrying this, the line before that was, she said, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Which I think I'd been waiting to hear that my whole life. And I didn't even know it. But sometimes you hear the words and all of a sudden it unlocks so much.
Okay, so I'm going to sort of, like we're stipulating for the jury for a second.
Let's
I'm going to sort
it.
Of stipulate yes. that when we talk about the adult portion of this journey, you go through a lot. There's a lot of alcohol use. You spend years living, working, thriving in bars. You participate in the porn industry at one point. There's a lot of drugs in your adolescence and early adulthood. I lay all of that out because we talked about the childhood part. We didn't talk about the adult part mm-hmm. as much. But we talk about the name of this book, which is Dirtbag Massachusetts. I've listened to some of the interviews. I've read the book. You don't really explain why you use the word dirtbag.
It's a great story, and I'd love to tell it right here.
Tell it.
Okay, so listen, bounced around the state quite a bit, lived different places, but where a core part of my younger years were spent after we got out of Boston, my teenage years were spent, I lived in a place called Athol, Massachusetts, out on Route 2. And I love it. It's right by the Quabbin Reservoir. It's absolutely beautiful. I want to be very clear about something. I'm incredibly proud of coming from Athol, Massachusetts. Now, the rest of the state, let's be honest, it was a low-income area in what is a very rich state. So that's part of this too. Class is very much a part of this book. But people would call it Rat Hole, Massachusetts. People would call it
Blink, blink, Massachusetts.
Yeah, I was going to say, am I allowed to say no?
No.
But we all know what, that's what I'm saying. We all know what I'm
Rhymes
about to say.
Rhymes with other things.
Right, yeah. Turns out you can't call a book that either. I tried.
Got it.
But so I was driving up with my friend Jason Diamond, who is an incredible author in his own right. And we were having a discussion about how you can't call it Massachusetts. You can't call a book that. And we literally were staying in a motel, like in the shadow of Fenway. I'm not joking. He was doing this beautiful event. And he just, so casually, he didn't miss a beat. He just turned to me and said, why not Dirtbag Massachusetts? And that was it. I won't lie. That at that point, 85% of the book hadn't even been written. Mm. But once I heard that, I knew that that was going to be a lodestar. That was going to be a guiding light to the stories that I wanted to tell.
Did you ever think you were a dirtbag?
Yeah. I still think I am. Let's be honest. That's, again, it's a messy book. This is not a book about, and now I've gotten all buttoned up, and now my life is on track. No, I think that's part of life. It's what I love. A lot of Catholicism is in this book. One of the things, don't get me wrong, there's parts of Catholicism, especially structured Catholicism, that I have issues with. But there's so many great lessons from Catholicism, and some of them are about forgiveness, and they're about meeting people where they are, and it's about allowing humans to be humans. We're messy. We are not perfect creatures, and that is something that is very important to me.
Good. So I want to really press on that a little bit.
I love this.
So, you know, you are now known in your media appearances, et cetera, with this vibrant, loving, I think, bubbly personality. Mm. And there's this other guy who's in this book. So, for example, I've got the cover right here in front of me. My copy of it is yellow and black, and it's got somebody crossing their fingers like, cross my heart, hope to die, or like, I'm not really telling the truth, so I got my fingers crossed. Every time I would walk over to the book to read the next essay, I kept imagining that instead what should be on the cover was a middle finger instead of fingers crossed. Isn't there a middle finger dimension to this?
Oh, 100%. And I won't lie. I've never had that thought. That is a truly original thought. And thank you for sharing. Because truly, as much as I would have liked to have called it Massachusetts, maybe it should have been a middle finger and not the crossed fingers. But that's absolutely right. There is anger. There's anger in that book. And there's anger inside me, and it's something that I'm still grappling with, and it's something that I'm still trying to understand, if I'm being completely honest. And that's what therapy is for. That is something that has really opened up so many doors in the last few years of my life. And allowing myself, it's okay. It's okay to have that feeling. Sometimes I think a lot of emotions we're told they're not okay, so you have to turn them down. I've learned to become a little bit more accepting of the angry child that I was.
So we're talking with author Isaac Fitzgerald about his new book, Dirtbag Massachusetts, follows his journey from happiness in early childhood in Boston to, rough life in Athol, Massachusetts. Then we go to San Francisco, we go to New York, eventually we resettle in New England. And it is a no man's and every man's tale of the journey from a painful childhood to figuring out, you know, how to love who you are. Is that fair?
I mean, that's more than fair. That's the kindest thing. Like, it means so much to me that you actually read the book and that you so clearly connected with it because you are clearly getting what I'm talking about. So sorry, that's more than fair. That's kind.
I'm glad and I appreciate that because as I read the book, I kept thinking, this cost him something. Mm. These are essays, right? I'm imagining you wrote them a little bit at a time.
Mm-hmm.
Did you pick, okay, now I'm ready to tackle X, now I'm ready to tackle Y? did they tell you, no, now here's what we're going to do, you better write this one? Or was there something more coolly strategic about how you put this together?
No, when I sold this book, it wasn't supposed to be about my childhood at all.
Well, wait, what was it supposed
to be? I'm telling you. It was supposed to be just disparate essays about different pop culture things. My idea, and there are many writers who I admire who have done this. I was like, okay, I'm going to tackle Star Wars and, like, maybe I'll touch on my father with my relationship. I'm going to tackle this and that. And there is still one essay in the book about the band The Hold Steady, who mean the world to me, and they're fantastic, and they're very much rooted in a lot of different places, but including Massachusetts. That essay was what it was all kind of supposed to be like.
Yeah.
And every time I sat down to write an essay like that, I'd be like, all right, touch on the relationship with the father. Oh, no, wait, hang on. I got to explain this. Oh, no, wait, hang on. It got so away from me. I realized I'm trying to force myself to write a book that I don't need to write. The things that I'm having a hard time looking at, the things that are difficult to be open about, that's where the story is. And so it was only by trying to put these essays that are not in the book on paper that I found the essays that are in the collection. And I had to write an email to my editor that was like, so I know I pitched you this one thing, here's what I've got. And she was so encouraging. And she kept saying, yes, this is actually it. And keep going.
Any essay that's not in the book that you now wish was?
There's an essay that I've written, it was a while ago, about why I ended up in New York, that we basically felt was a little bit too explainy for what we were going for here, so we took that out. I still am very, very fond of that essay, and I do hope people get to read it at some point.
Have you published it elsewhere?
No. It's like...
So that's the one you'd like to put out there.
Keep it in the back pocket, yeah.
So there are so many other things that I want to talk to you about in the content of the book, the writing of the book. You talk about your father a couple of times just now. You've mentioned, okay, I'd write about this and think maybe I should write about my father. And one of the things you make a point of when you talk about a journey, and we missed this earlier... You talk about a journey where you were in Athol, which you don't name in the book.
I think I do mention it maybe like once, but yes, it's not driven home in any way. Yeah.
And then you wind up in a boarding school
in
your sort of later teen years. Yeah. And it's an all boys, you know, it's better contained than Lord of the Flies, right? And it's academically strong, but it's an all boys boarding school.
Real quick. All boys dorm. It was actually
a
co-ed. God bless.
I didn't get that.
God bless. Yeah, don't get me wrong. When you're 14 and you move there, it feels all boys because you're just locked in a cement dorm building. But no, it is co-ed. But yes, my experience, especially in that first year, was very much an all boys experience.
And you got there because a woman in your life, in your community, saw the potential in you, a librarian, and offered to help you fill out the applications and stuff. And you go on to explicitly say, at some point I realized that there were women in my community who were seeing the pain I was in, who were seeing, you never say from your childhood that there was a man who stood up for you or showed up for you.
I think there's something to be said for that for numerous reasons. But one, my story in my life has actually been about seeking out father figures. And it's really interesting to hear you say that because you're dead on. That's not in the book, but that is something I've done a lot, but that is not in the book. But women in the community that I was in, librarians, secretaries at the school that I worked at, people who, like my parents also, to be clear, but loved books, really helped me get out of these situations. And then I did spend the rest of my life looking for a father figure, and I've had wonderful relationships come out of that. I've had wonderful examples of what it means to be a good man. And one thing that's happening now is I am reconnecting like with my father.
Climbed a mountain with
him. I climbed a mountain. But even then, we, you know, you've read that as, then,
you didn't
it's
really
not
talk.
Quite there. Yeah. But like we are figuring out a way forward because I now recognize the things that he experienced that maybe made him closed off to these conversations, which made me feel neglected. And so he reads the book, and so my mother writes, I'm sorry, I had no idea you were carrying this. My father, and I want to say this, I'm quite charmed by the man. He's very funny. He wrote back, I don't know what to tell you, childhood's tough.
Okay, so this is the moment then where we're going to have you read a little bit.
Okay.
Okay, and this is from the essay called Maybe I Could Die This Way. Yeah. You're grappling with suicidal thoughts, and I'm sorry about that.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
The undiagnosed mental illness that different family members of yours suffered from and how you weren't really able to talk about it with your family. We've just heard your dad be so deep, right? So read these couple paragraphs.
Here we go. When you can't talk about something, you're prevented from naming and describing it, from making it real. And what you can't name and describe and make real becomes infinite and limitless and impossible to decipher or resolve, because it can expand to fill your whole life and self to its tiniest corners, or it can shrink to nothing. Nothing being the size of things that are not real. You are alone with it, with yourself, with this unsolvable problem.
Author Isaac Fitzgerald reading from his new book, Dirtbag Massachusetts. And for listeners, if anyone is struggling with suicidal thoughts, the phone number for the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is 1-800-273-8255. That's 1-800-273-8255. So you did name it.
Yeah.
So now that it's real, what's possible for you that wasn't until you put this all on paper?
It's those conversations, not just with my parents, but with the rest of my family. It's watching my nephews and my niece and knowing that I'm going to be there for them, that I'm going to be able to support them as they grow older. And listen, like I said, nobody bats a thousand. Nobody's perfect. They're going to have their own hardships. But I know that I'll be just that much more able to communicate it. And that's what it comes back to with my father, too. His dad didn't talk to him about anything. My dad writes me an email. Yes, he says, hey, childhood's hard. But he also said, I mean, there are other jokes in there. Shouldn't have given you so much Bukowski to read as a young kid. That was hilarious. I mean, my parents did. They loved books. Like, that's why, in a way, I wrote a book to try and communicate with them. But the last thing my dad says in that email is, I'll see you at Thanksgiving. Because the whole family's going to get together. And we don't do that anymore. Back when I was a kid, people had to get driven around. Somebody's going to be here on this day. Somebody's going to be here on this day. Everyone was avoiding everyone. My siblings, now that they have the kids, everyone gets there on the day. Everyone either makes peace and sits down at the table or they're not invited. And it has been so beautiful to watch this family that had so many different issues figure them out, come back together, and be there for what's going to be the next generation.
So let's stay with manhood a bit longer.
Yeah.
And I'm going to describe you a little bit. Let's see, that's your left hand. You've got the word home tattooed across your fingers.
That's right.
Oh, and your right hand. Oh, come home. So it says come home when you look at it. You've got tattoos, some with Catholic themes, all up and down your forearms. You wear a tight shave on the sides of your head. You've got a mustache and beard. I bring all of this up because you have an essay in the book where you talk about barbershops.
Yep.
And you realize at some point that lots of different barbershops you've tried, the barbers say awful things to you. They say racist things. They say things that are about violence against women. At some point, they show you inappropriate pictures of other people who are racist or white supremacists. And at some point, you realize there's something about you that must be signaling that they think that's you too.
That's right.
And it's part of a larger discussion in the book about all the ways that you see your body and feel good about it or don't.
But what's happening in that moment, and that's, I really think what we're coming to, and this is why I love talking about this book, because I get to see what people take from it. And what you and I are talking about so much while we're having this wonderful conversation is communication. I'm talking about communicating with my family in this new way that feels so good. But part of communication is also expressing, like you were saying earlier, when you're upset, when you're angry, when you don't want to abide by something. And for the longest time in those spaces, and not just the spaces of the barbershop, sometimes at school, sometimes growing up, I would keep my mouth shut. I wouldn't speak up. And I would let things that I knew in my heart I didn't agree with, I would let them slide because that felt easy, because that was my way to glide through life. And something I'm learning as I get older is what that takes away from me every time I stay quiet. You can learn how to communicate in wonderful ways with the people you care about. You can also learn how to communicate when you're uncomfortable, when you're upset. And that's something I wish I'd known a lot earlier.
So somewhere out there is a little boy
in the anti-Harry Potter experience, who is young and suffering. You know, Chris and I, Chris Sidorick, the producer on this segment, and I were both thinking of Joel Christian Gill and his graphic novel Fights. We talked to him about it. And he told us he wrote about this traumatic childhood as a way to reach out to other young adolescents. So somewhere out there, there's a kid. And there's someone in their lives, maybe a woman and maybe in their case a man, who sees that they're hurting. What do you want them to do for that kid?
If this book can reach one person and can be a roadmap for them to get out of whatever rut they either find themselves in or maybe even mentally they are in on their own, that's the whole reason. That's the only reason to write something like this. I imagine this book as a soft cover folded up in a 14-year-old's back pocket because that's the book that I wish I had had. It feels grandiose even to speak it out loud. It's hard to express that, actually. But it's the truth. If I can hit one person with that where they read it and they say, hang on a second, I can figure out a few of these things a little quicker in myself, that will mean everything to me. One of my favorite lines, and I'm going to not say it word for word, but there's a play, History Boys, by, not going to remember the name, Alan something. Anyways, there's a line from the play History Boys. What's so special about reading is you can be sitting there looking, reading, and you'll come across a line or a thought or a moment or even an emotion that you think you only had. You yourself, you felt so lonely with it. And then you see it on the page, and it's like a hand comes out and it grabs yours, and you're no longer alone. Mm. If this book can do that for somebody, it will have been worth the 4, 8, 10, 20, however, it depends on when you think I started it, but maybe 30 years that it took me to write this book.
All right, so last question.
Hit me.
So now that 14-year-old you has this book in his back pocket.
Yeah.
He's read it.
Yeah.
What does he say to you today?
That 14-year-old boy, you know, he wouldn't say thank you because he's, you know, that's maybe something an older person would say, you know? But he would just say to me, I'm going to be more intentional in the way that I live my life. I realize that life is not just something I have to let happen to me. I can actually make decisions, learn how to communicate, get in touch with my own emotions, be okay with my own emotions and who I am. And I'm going to be more intentional in the way that I live my life.
That was Isaac Fitzgerald, frequent contributor on the Today Show and author of Dirtbag Massachusetts. Fitzgerald joined us here in Studio 2 earlier this week while he was in Boston for a book event. The playwright of the History Boys, by the way, Alan Bennett. And you can find a link to more info about Isaac's book on our website, radioboston.org. And again, if you or someone you love is experiencing a mental health crisis, you can call the new National Mental Health Hotline at 988. That number again is 988.
Ladies and gentlemen, the weekend.
Yep, it is. It's Friday, and regular listeners know that that means Cristela Guerra, WBUR Senior Arts and Culture Reporter, is here to give us some things to do around the region this weekend. Welcome back, Cristela.
Thank you so much.
So last week, so cool, you joined us from Mexico City. So I want to ask you, what's your favorite thing you brought back with you, like a souvenir or a memory, anything?
All of the food. And the visit to Frida Kahlo's childhood home, which I was so emotional sitting in that house in the yard, just where she set foot. I was really moved by that.
Amazing. I'm so glad you had that experience. All right. So we've got some experiences to have this weekend for people here. Heat notwithstanding, you're actually going to take us to the beach first. Go ahead.
Yes. So for those who love it, they really love it. It's a sand sculpting festival in Revere. It's from 8 to 9 all weekend. I think artists have already started, and you can see them as you kind of roll down the beach. It's called, the theme this year is Wonders of the World. And so you can make a day of it. Definitely bring umbrellas. It's scorching outside. Walk the boardwalk. Pack water and sunscreen.
And these are not like baby sandcastles. These are real sculptures.
Massive sculptures. I took my mom last year. She loved it. There's so many of them.
All right. So for those who do not want to be in heat index of 100, how about something inside? I think you have two
museum visits for us.
I do. Okay, so first, both the Ipswich Museum and the Addison Gallery of American Art in Andover are honoring Arthur Wesley Dowell, landscape painter from Ipswich, known as a mentor to Georgia O'Keeffe.
Wow.
He passed 100 years ago this year, and he did the seascape salt marches images of Ipswich in his day. Mm. So they've got the single, Ipswich Museum has the single largest collection of Dowell's paintings, it looks like. So woodblock prints, cyanotypes, I don't know if I pronounced that properly, but we're talking, I think it's Saturday 10 to 4 and Sunday 1 to 4. Tickets range from 5 to 15, depending on how old you are and how much of the museum you want to see.
And then the Addison Gallery has some piece of it as well?
It does. It looks like they're focusing more on the intuitive aspects of his work, the emotionality, and that's only on display until the end of the month. So that's Saturday 10 to 5, Sunday 1 to 5, and that one's free.
So you could hit a 1, too.
Exactly.
All right, so then the Huntington.
Yes.
Go ahead.
The Huntington. So the Breaking Ground Festival, this is highlighting local playwright fellows and national writers. These are not full performances. We've got readings happening. This is free, open to the public. And there's actually one this evening at 7:30. This is the, I think the ones that I've looked at are Rough Magic by Andrew Cianez,
yep.
Reimagining The Tempest, and then Black Mother, Lost Daughter by Fedna Jacquet, talking about police brutality, justice, and responsibility.
All right. And last but not least, you've got something cool and indoors to do with. Actually, I want to go back just to highlight those readings. Those are plays that have never been performed before.
I believe so, yes.
Yeah, that's such a cool angle. I want to make sure listeners knew that. So tell us about the puppet show.
So puppet show place, Go Home Tiny Monster, Saturday at 1 and 3 and Sunday at 10:30 and 1. It seems that Sylvie and her family of puppets find themselves without a home, and they're helped by their community. Tickets are $9, $12.50 for everybody else that's not a member. And we have, I think, a bit of sound.
Yeah, because it's a silent puppet show. So listen. Okay, so obviously not fully silent, but I wanted to play that music because if you watch, there's a little clip of the puppet show. It works. Like, your heart is breaking for the loss of the house, and the puppets are so cute, and you totally understand what they're saying.
I love it. I'm buying it. I'm going. Like, you've sold me, Tiziana. Like,
right,
I'm there.
Are you going to brave the heat at all this weekend?
Oh, yeah. I think every time I'm outside, I'm from Panama, first of all, second. Every time I'm outside, I think of the blizzards I've covered in my day. And I'm like, this is glorious. I'm going to do this up.
All right. That's WBUR senior arts and culture reporter Cristela Guerra with everything you could need for the heat wave weekend. Cristela, welcome back and thanks.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for joining us today and all week. Hope you'll join us again Monday for more Radio Boston.